Welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002 and has been broadcast on community radio in Preston, Swindon and St Albans. Bristol Community FM's chair Ali Grant and manager Pat Hart have, however, suspended Dialect indefinitely due to a nearly 30-minute long excerpt of a speech by Bible scholar Gail Ripplinger we aired in September 2015, but we're hoping to be back on BCFM soon. This week, The Big Short. Christian Bale and Ryan Gosling, a film from them, but really, you only get a decent film these days every couple of years, and this is one of those, and it's all about the Lehman Brothers crash, 2008. Also tonight, Cherie Townsend is in from Long Ashton, and we hear someone who's just recently come back from Colombia. Dialect is produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk. And if you want to join in, contact the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, who are just off Jamaica Street. Call them on 0117 909 6897 or visit them on the web at prsc.org.uk. And I'll repeat those details at the end of the show. But we start this week with a listen to The Big Short. It's a film out at the end of 2015, starring Christian Bale and Ryan Gosling. And it looks at the 2008 financial crash. Well, actually, no, of course, as we say regularly on this show, it wasn't actually a crash. It was a bailout, but it was nearly a crash. And it looks at some of the intricate details of how that managed to happen. Because, of course, the entire financial system apparently missed a trick, didn't it? So how safe are we now? It raises those questions too, doesn't it? How trustworthy are the bankers when actually they're just an ordinary company trying to make money for themselves out of us? So let's go now to the film The Big Short.
Smoke? In the late 70s, banking wasn't a job you went into to make large sums of money. It was a snooze.
How about those Mets?
Filled with losers, like selling insurance or
accounting. And if banking was boring, then the bond department at the bank was straight up comatose. We all know about bonds. You give them to your snot-nosed kid when he turns 15. Maybe when he's 30, he makes $100. Boring. That is until Louis Ranieri came on the scene at Salomon Brothers.
You might not know who he is, but he changed your life more than Michael Jordan, the iPod, and YouTube put together.
Hey, gentlemen, let's get some money in here. Let's make some money. What do you say?
You see, Lewis didn't know it yet, but he'd already changed banking forever with one simple idea.
The mortgage-backed security, or private label MBS. You've got your average person's mortgage, fixed rate 30 years, boring, safe, small payoff, right? But when you have thousands of them all bundled together, suddenly the yield goes up, but the risk is still small because, well, they're mortgages. And who the hell doesn't pay their mortgage?
What exactly is the credit rating on this bond?
This bond, gentlemen, is AAA rated.
This is exactly what the Michigan State Pension Fund has been looking for. I'll buy 20 million.
Oh, come on, live a little.
25 million.
The money came raining down. And for the first time, the banker went from the country club to the strip club. Pretty soon, stocks and savings were almost inconsequential. They were doing 50, 100, 200 billion in mortgage bonds and dozens of other securities a year. And America barely noticed as its number one industry became boring old banking. And then one day, almost 30 years later in 2008, it all came crashing down.
March, Bear Stearns was in a death spiral, and the Fed brokered its sale.
The worst financial crisis in modern times. But certainly the largest financial disaster in decades in this country, and perhaps the end of an era in American business.
In the end, Louis Ranieri's mortgage-backed security mutated into a monstrosity that collapsed the whole world economy. And none of the experts or leaders or talking heads had a clue it was coming. I'm guessing most of you still don't really know what happened. Yeah, you got a soundbite you repeat so you don't sound dumb, but come on.
Our financial institutions are strong.
But there were some who saw it coming. While the whole world was having a big old party, a few outsiders and weirdos saw what no one else could. These outsiders saw the giant lie at the heart of the economy, and they saw it by doing something the rest of the suckers never thought to do. They looked.
There's going to be a bailout.
Well, they had to. Right? The paper markets would
have
collapsed.
They knew.
Cash would stop coming out of ATMs. They had to backstop this.
They knew the taxpayers would bail them out. They weren't being stupid. They just didn't care.
Yeah, because they're crooks.
Banks took the money the American people gave them, and they used it to pay themselves huge bonuses and lobby the Congress to kill big reform. And then they blamed immigrants and poor people. And this time, even teachers.
And that was a clip from The Big Short, a film out the tail end of 2015, courtesy of Paramount Pictures. The film stars Christian Bale, Ryan Gosling and others, and it's about the 2008 crash. And it's quite an entertaining look at the kind of hypocrisy in the financial system and wishful thinking and groupthink that allowed it all to happen in the first place. And a reminder as well that it wasn't a crash, it was a bailout, because the bailout was there to avoid the crash. Another point, really important, is that the people that the bailout helped are two. One is the people with deposits above about £75,000 in banks in the United States and Britain, because those deposits are guaranteed by the government. Anyone with higher amounts than that would lose them if the bank collapsed. And the other people who would lose out if the banks did collapse are the bank shareholders. So these were very specific shareholders who were guaranteed that their company wasn't going to collapse by the government, unlike things like British Steel, etc., which have just been allowed to tank, and everyone who had shares in them had lost a lot of their money. So very special consideration given to the banks. And as was pointed out in that clip, the massive amount of bailout money went into lobbying Congress and lobbying Washington to make sure that there was no real changes to the system to stop it happening all over again. And also, of course, massive multi-million pound and dollar bonuses for the bankers that caused this crash in the first place through a lot of the false accounting that was going on. A lot of echoes of Enron. Something else I'd mention is that there's a brief mention of Salomon Brothers there, which was supposedly starting this idea of getting mortgages involved and using them as kind of collateral, even though the mortgages were at the time pretty safe. Of course, as the financial situation got worse in the US and in Britain, of course, those mortgage-backed securities, MBS, became more and more fragile every week. And the Salomon Brothers is a company which also had a large building as part of the World Trade Center in New York, which was under attack, of course, on the September the 11th attacks, the Salomon Brothers building. It's also known as World Trade Center Building Number 7, which conveniently collapsed, even though no plane hit it. So I wonder if that's part of this massive scam as well. Anyone that's not seen or heard about World Trade Center Building 7, do look it up. There's a lot of stuff on there, particularly on the very good website, Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. So Bear Stearns, Lehman Brothers, does all look a little bit like Enron, doesn't it? Of course, Enron was well before all this in 2008, but it was almost like a warning shot across the bows that everybody should see just how corrupt and crooked the Wall Street and City of London Financial Centre banksters had become. The film again, The Big Short, it's called, starring Christian Bale and Ryan Gosling, available at cinemas on DVD, and if you're lucky, maybe on YouTube somewhere.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Well, last week we spoke to somebody from the Bristol chapter of Positive Money. One of the things he said is that they did a survey of our MPs, and you would hope that the MPs had some kind of grasp and understanding of the money system, but their survey found they didn't at all. Only a handful of them, a tiny percentage of MPs, actually understand how money works, which is rather worrying since they're supposed to be looking after the entire economy for us. And I got hold of a book from the Odyssey Library. It's called The Story of Money. It's a small little handy little hardback written and illustrated by Ned Seidler. That's S-E-I-D-L-E-R, Ned Seidler. And it's published in 1965. And there's quite a lot of interesting facts in it about money, all I think which we could probably do with our schools right from children of 11 years old or so, getting a proper education in money and how it all works. And for example, here's some facts from that book, The Story of Money, that if money is not backed, they say, by precious metals, history tells us that it's worthless. Well, of course, our money today is mostly paper money. The metals that our coins are made from are not precious metals, they're base metals, so it's debased currency. So when you're trading in traditionally, a coin, a silver coin, etc., would actually be worth the face value of the coin. So the Spanish became very successful with their doubloons and their pieces of eight because they were guaranteed made of silver and other precious metals. They began circulating around the whole world as good valid currency, and it meant a great deal of domination by the Spanish of the international financial system. But of course, bit by bit, those coins have been undermined. Something quite famously called the Henry VIII copper nose coins. They all call him Old Copper Nose because Henry VIII debased the coinage here in Britain from silver down to copper, and he would give the copper coins a silver plating, and then people, as they used the coins, would rub off the silver plating from Henry VIII's nose on the coin, which was slightly raised. So he was called Old Copper Nose. Another thing is we've got goldsmiths and money changers who were the originators of bankers before banking was ever considered a sort of profession in its own right. Also important to see how the Rothschilds have operated over the centuries as key movers and shakers in the financial services industry. Really from 300 years or so on. And the Rothschild family were based in Frankfurt in Germany in the ghetto there, and ended up over a period of just a very short time after getting a good relationship going with one of the royals in that area, brother running each bank, banks in London, Paris, Vienna, Naples, as well as the home bank in Frankfurt. And of course, they're extremely powerful to this day, get very much involved in politics with Victor Rothschild, people may know, being very much a mover and shaker under the Thatcher government to do with privatisation, etc. And of course, still others today, like Jacob Rothschild, Nathaniel Rothschild, who's a Bullingdon Club colleague, friend, pal, chum of David Cameron, Boris Johnson, and many of the senior people in the Conservative Party. Also, the ancient Egyptians had no money. Did you know that? They had a system of credit and bookkeeping, rather like compared by Ned Seidler to modern credit card systems. So it's almost as if we're going back to the original Egyptian money system where people are not actually given money. They just have credit assigned to their name by somebody who, of course, may just decide to switch your credit off or on, or it be fraudulent. So the idea is to really keep anything precious out of our own hands. And entrust it to the bankers, of course, who are not necessarily trustworthy. There's a quote also from Somerset Maugham, who said, "Money is like a sixth sense, without which you cannot make use of the other five." Worth bearing in mind, too, that throughout medieval times, charging interest, known as usury, in Britain and all over Europe, was illegal. So you weren't allowed to make money out of having money, which is, become a massive fake kind of industry, even though it's not really an industry, it's just a kind of bookkeeping process, paper pushing process. It would have been illegal all those years ago because they recognised that money would be channeled in, funneled into a tiny number of hands, and the whole country would become destitute. So they decided not to allow it. We're living at the moment in a housing bubble, a property bubble, and a asset bubble. So that's house prices, share prices are artificially highly inflated. And the book looks at something called the Mississippi bubble, back in 1716. It's also known as the Louisiana Bubble, because obviously the Mississippi is in Louisiana. And this Scotsman, John Law, was living in France, and he became very friendly with the Duke of Orleans in France and managed to convince thousands of wealthy investors right across France to invest in the Mississippi and in Louisiana because of the gold deposits and silver deposits. And he said there were all these mines over there. And because he had the support of the Duke of Orleans and other senior noblemen, if you can call them that, or gentry in France, he created a kind of a wave, almost like a kind of Ponzi pyramid selling scheme for these his projects to develop these gold and silver mines in the Mississippi area. And it was all completely fake, and then the whole thing collapsed. So that was a bubble that was pumped up in 1716 and then went bang as everyone lost their money. And then John Law, surprise, surprise, fled France. Also, stock exchanges, we get used to those all over the world today, but there was in 1531, there was really only one major stock exchange in the whole of Europe, and that was the Antwerp Bourse. The word bourse was sort of predated the idea of stock exchanges, but it's pretty much the same thing. And another thing that Ned Seidler finally points out in his book is that throughout the centuries, paper money has always been associated with manipulation and fraud. So get the paper money in your wallet out, see what it says on it. And if it says that you can exchange it for a pound of gold or anything like that, I would do it if I was you, because as Ned Seidler says, it's always associated, paper money that isn't backed by gold, with manipulation. And that book is called The Story of Money by Ned Seidler, written and illustrated by him. And it's part of the Odyssey Library, published way back in 1965. It's published by Paul Hamlin Limited.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk. UK.
So I'm joined now by Chris Pothecary, who's just come recently back from Colombia. Chris, first of all, where is Colombia?
Well, Colombia's in South America, right at the top, in between Venezuela and Panama. And then to the south, you've got Ecuador. Colombia as a country is an extremely very varied geographical makeup with jungle, the Andes Mountains, they've got deserts, there's virtually every different kind of ecosystem that you can find on the planet.
But it was so-called discovered, actually it had been discovered already by a bunch of Native Americans, but the Bardi Bank we were just hearing last week was the bank in Florence financed John Cabot's trip to North America, and also Christopher Columbus's trip to South America and the Caribbean. And I wonder, maybe we should sort of rewind almost to those days when the first settlers and the first navigators went and started mapping the coast of South America, because there was quite a powerful, strong indigenous culture there before the conquistadors.
There was indeed, yeah. Colombia's got a huge range of different tribal peoples, yeah. From the Kogis up in the north, and then in the jungle you've got the Cofan, Siona, and then you've got the Paez Indians in the Andes.
Okay.
There's many, many different
groups.
You've
lost me slightly, because I'm thinking about things like Aztecs, Incas, Mayans, no?
Aztecs, nothing to do with Colombia.
That was Mexico. Yeah. So what were the main, I mean, were the Mayans not there?
No, the Mayans is Mexico. The Incas had some connection to Colombia. And there are some indigenous groups in Colombia that are descended from the Incas. They moved up from Peru. But then they assimilated a lot of the culture of the indigenous people in Colombia. So they're a kind of a fusion, yeah?
See, because, I mean, we're sort of, I suppose, sold a lie then, aren't we, that South America was different to North America, with lots and lots of different Native American tribes in North America, that there were actually a handful of big civilizations. It sounds to me as if what you're saying is that the truth is that there was a similar kind of thing with lots of different
loads. And if you go to any country in South America, you'll find out that the ethnic groups are numerous, and languages as well. There's loads of different languages, and there's probably hundreds of groups in Colombia.
Colombia now, though, and I've travelled in South America a bit, a lot of the ordinary people curse the United States for, particularly since the Second World War. I mean, the Europeans before that, obviously, but for trying to install US puppet leaders in all of the South American countries, places like Brazil, where they were aided by ex-Nazis, for example. And so what's the situation in Colombia nowadays? We know a little bit about Venezuela, which is next door, which is oil rich, and where Hugo Chavez was very much standing up to the Americans. What's it like in Colombia?
Well, Colombia is a country that's been living probably the longest internal conflict on the planet. Since 1948. In 1948, there was a leader called Jorge Eliezer Gaitan, who was a revolutionary, self-taught, with a lot of different kind of ideas about redistribution of the wealth, education for the people. And he was assassinated on the 9th of April, 1948.
Well, a bit of a sort of Colombian Che Guevara?
No.
No.
Not really, no. I mean, he was a lawyer. But he came from a very poor background, and he was going to become the next president, and he got assassinated. As the years have gone by, investigations have discovered that the CIA were behind his assassination.
Surprise, surprise.
They actually tried to accuse his assassination on Fidel Castro, because Fidel Castro happened to be in Bogota the day he was assassinated. But it's much more likely that the United States had something to do with that.
Yeah, I'd agree.
And
with that
caused a 10 to 15 year long bloodbath in Colombia, where thousands and thousands of people were murdered. And out of that emerged the guerrilla movement. So the guerrilla movement took shape in 1964 in the guise that it's known nowadays. Yeah.
Is that the FARC guerrillas?
The FARC, yeah.
F-A-R-Q. What does that
F-A-R-C.
Stand for? F-A-R-C. F-A-R-C, okay. What does that mean in English?
In English, Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia.
Okay. What brought you initially, and when did you first go to Colombia?
Well, I went to Colombia because I was in search of indigenous knowledge, basically, and I've always been interested in medicinal plants and study of different ways of curing, alternative ways of curing illness. So I travelled down to Colombia in search of that, and I didn't really know much about Colombia at that point, but I did go to a guerrilla area when I first went there. So through that, I got to know a lot about the situation, and I lived with the local people down there for a lot of years.
Well, I guess you weren't taking Foreign Office advice on where to travel and what not to travel.
I certainly never even looked at the Foreign Office advice on whether they wouldn't have advised anyone to go to Colombia.
And so what made you do that? Because a lot of people travelling to that part of the world will think, well, actually, there are certain places we shouldn't go. And it sounds to me, in a way, what you're saying is they're actually the most interesting places.
Well, I think I had a bit of a thirst for adventure, and it was a circumstance which occurred where I made a contact, and I went. It was kind of by accident, but I was quite interested anyway in finding out, and I found it quite intriguing. I'd heard a lot about Colombia. You know, the media image you get of Colombia is drug trafficking, yeah, guerrillas, warfare, and all of that kind of thing.
But it is, I mean, that's the reality as well, because a lot of the FARC guerrillas make their money from drug trafficking, just as the government makes its money from drug trafficking or the paramilitaries, etc. So it's yeah, almost impossible to separate Colombia and
well,
drugs.
The thing that's happened down there, for example, when in the first years I was there, it was the place I went was a coca growing area, yeah? So a lot of the small farmers have a hectare or two of coca, yeah? And those are in regions of Colombia where the possibility to make a sort of stable living off other kind of crops is very difficult because the roads are bad, transport often breaks down. If you want to get things to market, you can't guarantee prices. So people have a little bit of coca on the side. A lot of people, there are big farms as well, yeah? So the people are cultivating in order to sustain themselves, yeah? But the whole thing that got pushed forward by the states, and around the time I went there in 97, 98, they were talking about Plan Colombia. And Plan Colombia was a United States initiative and funded with billions of dollars to overcome the production of coca by fumigating with Roundup. Monsanto are the manufacturers of Roundup, yeah? In reality, as time wore on, what we discovered was that it was nothing to do really about stopping the trade of cocaine. It was all to do about territory. So where they got the guerrillas out, the paramilitaries, who are right-wing groups, moved in, the coca growing continued, and it was all just about controlling who it is that's growing it and also controlling the supply, yeah? The actual amount of land in Colombia that is being used to grow coca has not changed in all of the time that Plan Colombia has gone on. It's just the owners of, or the territorial drug lords have changed. The FARC initially were involved in, and they would say that they don't actually get directly involved in the coca, they just tax the trade in it, yeah? Now, that's probably not 100% true in all cases, and certainly quite a few FARC members have got their hands dirty, and it has affected them very much. So it's something that the whole cocaine thing is something that touches every level of Colombian society, yeah? Right from, and indeed the drug czar that was sent over from the United States to oversee Plan Colombia, his wife was caught with 5 keys of top grade cocaine in her diplomatic luggage. So, I mean, there's...
Hey, that's not fair. You're not supposed to open the diplomatic luggage, are you? Yeah. Anyway, look, Chris, what about the ordinary local people that you've met? I know you've got a bit involved in the Campesino movement, and which is basically Colombian peasants. Mm-hmm. What are the pressures on them, and what have you been doing as part of the campaigns to make sure they get their rights?
Well, first of all, I mean, the involvement in that took quite a long time. I was there for 8 or 9 years before I got directly involved in that, because there was a government in Colombia who had basically one of the paramilitary leaders in all but name. His name was Uribe, who he was in control of the country. And so in the first time I lived there, it was very difficult to talk to people because people were nervous and there were paramilitary death squads roaming the country, cutting up people with chainsaws, and all sorts of stuff was going on. Over 6 million people were displaced from their homes. But in 2010, a new government came in and they started a new peace process. Now, in Colombia, there's been many peace processes over the years, and the government have usually made the deal and then killed the guerrillas who've given their arms in. Yeah, but there's a new peace process going on, and in the light of that peace process, from 2010 onwards, a lot of people started to emerge and start to talk. So in that climate, I, along with other friends, began to attend different campesino meetings, also with the aim of informing people about genetic modification and stuff like that, because Colombia's been flooded by GM maize, but it's not labelled, and people don't know what GM is there.
That's right, because maize, you know, traditionally, was the staple of the continent that allowed the big civilizations to grow, pre the conquistadors. So what's the dangers in the GM, and is it, do you think, deliberate that these big companies don't let the locals know?
Well, it's certainly deliberate because they want to control the seed. Because if you can control the seed, you can control the population. 25 years ago, it is said that in Colombia, they grew 90% of their own maize from traditional seed sources. Now, 85% is imported maize seed, and the majority of that is GM. But like I say, a lot of it is sneaked in, if you like. I mean, if you go to the markets and you buy maize, we've actually got to know the difference between GM maize and normal maize. And you can tell the difference. But a lot of the people, what they are being, if you like, hypnotized by is the promise of bigger yields, yeah, so that they can grow more,
the
they can put chemicals
bigger,
on
but
it.
But you can't save the seeds. Because it's...
You can't save the seeds.
It's a kind of terminated...
But once the people get in the cycle, you see, they've then lost... They've lost the original seed and they have to go and buy it. So this is one of the things that we've been trying to help to campaign on, to get people to understand that it's really important to save the seed. And it's important not to lose the older varieties of maize.
I mean, have the people been suspicious about you as a Westerner over there saying, hi, guys, I'm here to help you? And they think to themselves,
certainly,
hey, just like Monsanto.
Well, I went... In 2013, there was a national campesino strike, which paralysed the country for about 3 weeks. And in that time, I went with another friend, a Colombian lady, and we joined the strike. So we were at a site where there was 3,000 or 4,000 Colombian campesinos camped out under plastic. We arrived there. We knew of a couple of people. We had some names of people that we could get contact with who were going to be in the protest. But we were checked over by the people, and we were sat by a tent, and about 15 lads came over and started questioning us. They were very hostile. We told them the name of one guy who was our friend there, and apparently he was a well-known leader. So they went and spoke with him. He told them that we were okay. So they then came and apologized to us. And after that, they invited us to go and speak with them. So we ended up speaking with 200 or 300 people. People were really friendly. The hospitality of those people, when you go to these places where you've got a lot of very poor, simple, in a positive manner, yeah, and uncomplicated people, they will share absolutely everything with you. You become like family within a few days. So after that experience and negotiating, if you like, the initial hostility, we were accepted and actually I've become really good friends with these people. And once you become friends with them, yeah, you've got friends for life.
You're going to be going back again soon. What's your mission?
Well, I'd like to be able to while I'm here, to give out information a little bit about what is the actual on-the-ground situation of people over there. Because I think people here don't know much about the situation in Colombia, and there are huge areas of the country where you don't get media going in. You won't get journalists going in to talk to the people. And the people don't receive much information either. And that's one of the problems that they have.
Yeah. And is the peace process, is that looking good or not?
Well, the peace process, they say they're pushing to have it signed and sealed by next month. Yeah. Now, the problem that's going to occur with it is that there's been a huge build-up of multinational interest in Colombia, because Colombia is extremely rich in a lot of resources. And because of the guerrilla warfare over the last number of decades, a lot of multinationals have been afraid to invest in Colombia because of the threat of having workers kidnapped by the guerrillas and so on. So there is now sort of the promise, if you like, of Colombia, the doors of Colombia being opened for international investment. And there is a string, for example, the main river in Colombia is called the River Magdalena. And the River Magdalena is a river that runs from the south of Colombia to the north and goes out into the Caribbean Sea. And there's a plan of something like 33 hydroelectric dams, which they want to, which, you know, the Colombian government is asking for bids, basically. They've got Chinese and Spanish and Italian companies in there. And they are flooding the best farmland. They're turfing people out of their homes. If people protest, they send the riot police in. And in these protests, and the protesters I was in, they use live bullets. So, you know, it's not just tear gas. They'll do whatever is necessary. And for that reason, I mean, there's a big campaign in Colombia and there's very brave people, because in Colombia, if you go and protest, you will be on a death list, basically. Years back, anybody that was apparently in any way a collaborator with the guerrillas, and a collaborator with the guerrillas would be someone perhaps that just gave them some food because they passed through their land and asked for food. Yeah, they would be shot, they would be rounded up, people were cut to pieces with chainsaws in front of their families. Yeah, the thing has changed a bit now because the profile of the peace process means that Colombia has to control the human rights abuses. And the Congress in the United States were making different conditions, especially the Democrats, that Colombia had to get this under control. So what happens now is they target key people and they pick them off. They won't do the sort of open massacres now. But I know people there that they have to go around with bodyguards, because anybody who actually stands up and speaks is under immediately under on the death threat.
But you want to go back?
Yeah.
What will you be up to over there?
Well, I mean, I live in a community. I live a farming life. I've always been pulled towards that, and I love it. I love living in a campesino.
So what, have you got a kind of allotment there?
Yeah, I've got. I live with other friends on a piece of land, and we grow our own food.
Do you grow coca?
We use coca for medicine, and coca is a very good medicinal plant. And when it's used in its natural form, there is nothing wrong with coca at all. In fact, it's a vitamin supplement, and it cures many different illnesses. So yeah, we grow coca, and we're not ashamed of it.
Tell us a bit about your community. What's it like there? Because I imagine it's in a part of the country that if you were going to go to your travel agent and say, I want to go to Colombia, they say, well, don't, whatever you do, go there.
Well, I mean, the part of the country that we're in now, initially the place that I went to was in the jungle, but our community was displaced by the violence as well. And we were attacked by the paramilitaries, and also at a certain point the guerrilla said the thing was getting so dodgy there that they advised anyone that wasn't willing to take up arms to leave the area. So we had to leave the area. We had to get everything into the back of a lorry, and we had to go and find another piece of land. And we had to, we lost the whole community. We had a school, we had a communal house, we had various different plots with different members of the community.
So
and
you had
those
to
are Colombian people, yeah.
Have you had to rebuild that?
So we've had to rebuild from scratch over the last 13 years. And myself and a few other English friends, we've joined the community and we've helped in that process. And at times we've come back and worked in England, and we bring a little bit, we bring some of the money that we're able to make there over to help the community rebuild itself. And how the community's big, also opened its doors, if you like, to a lot of young Colombian people who want to get back to the land. Yeah. So
how big is it?
I mean, we're about 30 people, but we've got various different...
That doesn't really sound enough to be sustainable, maybe, you know, just from farming or whatever.
I mean, to be totally sustainable, when you've got to rebuild a community and build all your houses, we do have to buy a certain amount of our food. We're not completely 100%, but that's a learning process, and not all of us were born as campesinos. So to actually adapt and to get to the physical condition where you can work the land... And because these people are tough, and a normal campesino will work a 10-hour day, and they work, and you don't know what work means until you meet these people. They're amazing.
Aren't you ever tempted to come back and live a bit of a more cosy life with your car and your telly and
I'm doing that a bit at the moment. I mean, I don't dislike England, and it's my home country. I love the countryside in Britain. You know, I'm a Somerset lad, born and bred. So yeah, it's great to come back here. But when you make a life in another place, you create very strong connections with that place. And I love Colombia. Colombia, despite the image of Colombia, you see, the people in Colombia are very, very warm, friendly people. And the majority of people there are, you can meet people, and within a few hours, you are like family with them. If you haven't got anywhere to stay, they'll give you a bed. You know, there's no people haven't got the same sort of insecurity, strangely enough, as people have got here, to talk to a stranger or to and now that the peace process is going on, the good thing for the people there with it, although there's a threat of multinational intervention, it is allowing Colombian people to open up and actually show what they really are. And the culture, the expression, the freedom with which people express themselves is inspiring. So, you know, I love Colombia, I love its people, and you know, I feel very connected to the place, and you know, it's part of my life. So.
A bit like the sort of Somerset ambassador to Colombia, maybe.
They probably don't even know where Somerset is. I mean, there's people there who live out in the sticks who, they say, where are you from? You say England. They say, what part of Colombia is that then? So...
Okay, so what about following news from over there? Is there anywhere that you would recommend, maybe online or elsewhere, to actually point us towards, to say, well, here's somewhere where you can follow what's happening in Colombia, because we certainly don't get anything on the news.
Well, that's an interesting point, because I don't actually currently know of English-speaking or websites and so on where there's much information about Colombia. I think there's some guys in Ireland have got Colombia Solidarity. If you put Colombia Solidarity, there was a Colombia Solidarity group in England. I don't know if they're still going. But I'd actually quite like to do some stuff myself and try and get some more information out there.
Well, maybe to blog from Colombia. If you've got any internet access at all?
Yeah, you can get internet access there. There's all the towns are full of internet cafes. I mean, on where you live, you won't get it. You won't get broadband in your home or anything, but you can go out and get onto the internet easy enough.
Well, you can get away from the electro pollution over in Colombia, it sounds like. Anyway, Chris Pothekeri, thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Okay, Tony, thanks very much.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk. UK.
And I'm joined in the studio now by Cherie and Red Townsend. Hi, you two.
Hi.
Hello.
Now, I suppose I should introduce you first in a way, Red, because you did a programme on BCFM, didn't you? You haven't done that for a while.
No, I stopped it
the past 2 years.
Is that just from too much work to do at school, having boyfriends? What's why?
Too much to work to do at school, so I focused on my A-levels instead.
Okay, well, what did you get from doing that? Do you look back thinking, what was I doing, or do you miss it?
I kind of wish I did it still, but at the same time, I don't regret the things I've done in the time that I didn't spend
doing that.
Yeah. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. Do you think you'll go back to it at some point?
Maybe. Hopefully.
And what about having your ideas pinched? Do you think that's happened? Because, I mean, you used to do that hot or not slot. That's also been picked up by other people. I think that happens, you know, when people do good shows on community radio, sometimes ideas do get pinched. Do you think maybe that's true, or am I being a bit paranoid?
That would be a really, really flattering idea, but maybe I just wasn't being very original and other people had those ideas as well. But I'd be quite happy if those ideas were stolen, because it's mine.
What about, just tell us a bit about how you did those shows, because you were very, how old were you when you first started?
10, 11, 11, and then stopped when I was 16.
And what was your, were you on any sort of mission, or was it just whatever happened that day on the radio you just chatted about?
Well, it started off kind of being a bit more organised, and we'd have to spend time organising the show and everything and writing it down. But then I got a bit bored and just turned up and we were like, oh, let's speak about this today.
Well, of course, if you run out of things to say, you can always play a record.
Yeah, that's what we used to do all the time. But yeah.
What about music now? What kind of, because you're 18 now, what are 18-year-olds listening to? Are you too busy doing your schoolwork?
No. I do art. It's not that hard.
Okay.
But, like, it depends. There's a new thing called grime. It sounds a bit weird. And it's like rap, but more kind of ghetto and a bit, like,
grimy.
Street. And so that's what everyone is listening to, and, like, drum and bass. But I don't really like that kind of stuff.
So what do you like?
Kind of mixture of things. I don't know. I always find music questions really pressury, because what if I say something wrong?
Look, I'm just, you know, give us a couple of artists that you actually got a bit of time for and respect, and you reckon, you know, you can listen to them again and again that are reasonably up to date.
Well, actually, this morning I was listening to a band called Walk the Moon, and I'm going to see them at the O2 in February, hopefully.
What kind of music's that?
It's kind of like bob your shoulders to it, and it's kind of happy. That's what I was listening today. Yeah, and I don't really know anything else.
Now, Cherie, your Red's mum, tell us a bit about her education, because she was home educated, wasn't she, for quite a while?
Red and her twin, Griff, who she used to do the radio show together for like 3 years. And I do believe that started off originally by the very glamorous lady, Sabrina. We were at College Green Library, not home educating, just let them do what they want, really, and, you know, wandering around, reading books, enjoying themselves. And she took a shine to them and just basically come over and start talking to us. We went in, Joe took a shine to the girls, and after they first went on and just started chatting about things they'd done, because I believe by then you'd been in a movie as well, hadn't you? So did you know that?
Which film was that?
She played an 8-year-old Christina Ricci, Penelope. So there's a picture of Red on big screen, 50-foot big with the nose of a pig.
Red.
Sorry, darling.
Do you want mum to shut up about this now?
No, it's all right.
So basically, of course, you know, they were 10, 11 years old, and they were just talking about Red being on in a movie. And Joe liked how the twins were bouncing off of each other. And then from there, had their slot, which was before your slot on Friday afternoons.
What about home education? Now, you can't really get GCSEs like that. I suppose you might be able to, but you decided
not to.
You can,
but you have to pay. Whereas, you know, I mean, in all fairness, we were saving, you know, the government, at least £6,000 a year per child by that child not being in school. Yet we had to pay for the exams for each child. That was why I did put them back into school, being extremely lazy to do their A-levels and GCSEs. I believe you're very grounded from being
How did you find it though, arriving at school, Red?
From home education, from being home educated to school was horrible. I remember after my first day, I came home and I started crying, and I was like, Mom, everyone's so mean, so horrible.
And really upset.
Yeah, it was a complete change of environment. Really hard to
actually
adapt to.
School kids can be pretty ruthless, can't they?
It wasn't the school children. I mean, in all fairness, you used to come home really traumatised, saying that the students wouldn't communicate with the teachers properly. The teachers wouldn't communicate with the students properly. So, of course, you've got all that animosity, all that rage, all that aggression. Then when the doors are shut, oh, let's forget about it. Oh, it's the next day now, let's start again. So you can see why some of these children come in the next day and do really crazy things to the teachers, or teachers go round the bend, because nothing ever, ever gets resolved, ever, within the school. I had the teachers phoning me up after Red was in there for a couple of months, saying, you know, we're really concerned about your daughter, she needs to see a counsellor. I said, if you think so, then that's fine. And Red was saying, please let me, because I can have a free cup of tea.
Yeah.
And I think I got biscuits,
didn't you?
It was the
most insulting thing. Yeah. This woman came in, Red, it's time for your... And I was just like, what? And then she showed me to a poster and was writing notes down about what I was saying to her. And I was just kind of like, I don't really want to be here, but I'll speak to you. She's like, oh, don't worry, all of what I'm telling you won't go anywhere. And then I was like, well, why are you writing what I'm saying down? Like, this isn't making me feel very comfortable.
Well, also, I mean, it almost treating you like you're stupid.
Yeah. And then she asked me, she pointed towards a poster behind her and said, which eggshell do you feel like today? And I burst out laughing, and I was just like, I don't think I'm going to see you again, but thanks for your time. And then she gave me a cookie, but it was just so weird.
Was it a delicious cookie there?
No, it was only plain digestive. But
that's not very good, is it? A digestive biscuit for all that.
I thought you were on about... it just goes to show that obviously there's too much money to have counsellors, whatever, in school, when if they regress back to younger children, they can probably... deal with a lot of things with regards to how people are behaving, how people are communicating. If adults can't communicate with each other, I mean the more mature students and the teachers, until they get to sixth form, obviously things seem to change in the sixth form, and there's people seem to be able to communicate. But you were so traumatised, Red. Griff didn't really care. She, everything bounced off of that one. You did, though. And the teachers couldn't see that.
Maybe Red is more sensitive or something. Why was that?
I take everything personally.
It's a twin thing.
I'm really glad.
But you went to two different schools, didn't you? An independent school and a state school. Is that right?
Yeah.
What ages?
Well, it was year 4 to year 5.
I think it goes 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4 with me.
So is that for your GCSEs, up to your GCSEs?
Well, no, we were about 8 to 10, we were in...
No, it was younger than that. I think you came out when you were about 9, independent, then home educated for 4 years, 5 years, and then state school for exams.
From year 9, yeah. So that was the age of 12,
and when you started 13. In the state schools, I mean, all they'd done was hour of maths a week, hour of English, hour of science, and music, of course, and ice skating and swimming and taekwondo and whatever else we felt we wanted to do. Obviously I had some tutors for that as well. And the tutors that we would get were the students that had just finished a degree or something, because they were looking for £10 an hour, where these other people would charge you £30, £40 an hour.
Well, look, I'm going to ask both of you separately. First of all, you, Red, what would you think would be the advantage or not disadvantage of actually the time you spent at state school doing your exams? I mean, did you feel that because you've had a bit of everything? What do you think, if you could change the state school system, the way you were being taught in the institutions, what would you change?
I would change quite a lot about
go on then, off
education
you go.
System. Okay, first of all, with my GCSEs, I kind of stressed out, and there was other things going on, and I didn't really know what to focus on, and there were so many different, I don't know, you had to sit like 24 exams in the space of 3 months, which was really horrible. And so I gave up. I was like, I don't want to do it anymore, I'm just going to concentrate on my A-levels. So I wouldn't revise, and I was just had this whole, I'm not going to do well, so I'm not even going to focus on one. Whereas if they separated it out a bit nicely, like it's going to be easier for you to focus on one subject at a time. So you can do, you know, at the beginning of June, all of your English. And then sort it rather than, oh, today you have 2 science exams and tomorrow you have art and English. And it was really weird. And they're really different with the art subjects. The teachers kind of shun it upon you, like, oh, you chose drama and art. And it's kind of really insulting, because I remember on my results day when we came in and we had to tell the teachers what we got, so they wrote it down on a piece of paper so that the school could look good on a league table or something. And I did really, really well in my drama, and that was the best grade I got, and it was highest, and I was so proud of it. And the woman was really, really rude to me about it, because she's quite an academic woman, and I thought that was really rude. So that would be one of the main things I'd change.
What about you, Cherie, from what you've seen? I mean, how should we change the state school system?
With regards to seeing how my children... I would assume, from really back to basics, the classes should be smaller. With regards with what Red said about all the exams and having to do science or having to do this subject in a day, if the teachers knew the children through having smaller classes, then they would know by looking at them the way they're acting what sort of subject they would want to do, which would benefit them, make them feel more comfortable. And also not the restriction on learning as well, which I do believe you have in schools. Yeah. You know,
I remember in science, I'd ask, why? And the woman would say, oh, you don't need to know that. You need that for A-levels. So, well, we're not going to speak about it, and we're going to move on to the next topic. Yeah.
They do that as well, don't they? Where I remember you saying when you come home that cert, because when they started off after being home educated, they put the middle groups. Of course, they went up, but they put them in middle groups first of all. Now, we found out that when you're in that middle group, you won't learn what someone will learn if they're going to get a grade A, because you're probably only going to get grade C. So let's dumb you down just
at
that level.
Well, this is streaming, is it, you're talking about?
That's awful. Yeah. How can that?
They limit you to your grade. Oh, you're not in the higher group, so we're only going to teach you the grade C thing.
It doesn't make sense. Griff as well. Griff didn't turn up for one of her A-level exams, but in the first year, she got a C. How can you get a C for doing 1 year of exam? If Griff had sat the exam that day, she would have obviously got an A. She would have done really well, but she didn't go in for the exam. Now, how can you, in 1 year of doing a two-year exam, how can you be graded a C? It's...
Sounds crazy.
It is.
Also, another thing you have to do as a mum is you have to make some big decisions for your children when they're very young.
Yeah.
About things like whether or not to vaccinate. This is a horrid subject, because it's an absolute minefield. You've got a whole load of big, powerful drug companies out there trying to persuade you to do it. You've got a media that you're never quite sure, are they telling us the truth, or are they just a mouthpiece for the big drug companies? What's your have you had to struggle with those sorts of things, Cherie?
Yes, I would say the twins had more vaccinations than their little sister. I mean, when Drew was born, she didn't have the prick in the... Red and Griff had the prick in the bottom of the vitamin K1. I refused to have that with Drew and said I wanted it orally. The nurse turned around to me and said, there's no point in doing it orally because it won't work. I said, if that's the reason, why is it an option? What they meant to say is we're too lazy and we don't want to administer it, you know, to the child over however long at such a time. That was why they didn't want to do it that way. Also with vaccinations, what scares me is there's no physical way I can find out what is in each vaccination, yet I know more about my mobile phone. Now, you know, that's heartbreaking that I'm being bullied, forced, whatever, or told, you know, this is better for, you know, that everybody, honestly, we are helping your child, injecting that into my child, but having no idea what it is about and having no way of finding out what it's about.
Didn't they also, when you were pregnant with me and Griff, didn't they tell you, to give you a certain injection or something so that we wouldn't have something wrong with us, a disability?
A rhesus negative blood. 25 when I was pregnant with you two, they wanted to do an amniosis test to see if I had a Downs baby. Yeah, so, and in all fairness, I have no idea if that would have come back positive because there was a chromosome deficiency because there was twins in there. No idea how that would have worked out. But I said, no, I don't want to have that done because there is a chance of having a miscarriage. And they said, oh, but it's a very small chance. I said, but it's still a chance. No, but it's a very small chance. I said, okay, so if I did have this test and something was wrong, what could you do about the situation? They said, nothing. I said, so why is it an option? So there you go. Yeah.
Doesn't seem to make...
So I didn't have it, by the way.
It doesn't seem to make a lot of sense.
But no. It you know, and yeah, yeah.
We've had a case just over the last few weeks here in Bristol reported on Points West of a mother who had her I think it was her daughter, no, her son, vaccinated for swine flu, which he probably wouldn't have got because this is something pretty obscure. And they've now got, I think, nearly £250,000 of compensation because this young lad has now got sleep apnea and he just falls asleep at the drop of a hat. Yeah.
And it's because of the
vaccine. It does make you wonder, doesn't it, about some of these, what's
so
in
them.
So
that's to do with bird flu?
Swine flu.
So swine flu, is that linked with bird flu?
Probably, yes, I think so. Okay. And a lot of these flus, you're not really sure quite where they're coming from. We've had also this Zika virus thing. I don't know if you, I think you've been looking into it a bit.
I could be mistaken, but the H5N1, which is type of influenza bird flu, and it's allegedly difficult to transmit from person to person. But this H5N1 that's difficult to transfer from person to person is allegedly, again, I have no facts with me now, in the genetically modified mosquitoes that have been sent over to South Africa, originally to allegedly so that only the reason they were genetically modified is so that only 5% of them when they reproduced would be male, but now they've reproduced, they're trying to say that this is why Jamaica, South America are not allowed to have babies within the next couple of years.
It's worth. I mean, I did a little bit of an internet search on this, and there's all sorts of speculation out there. But there's a certain amount of facts about the Zika. That is that the name Zika comes from a Ugandan forest where a research station was set up. I think it was even just before the Second World War by the Rockefeller Foundation to research viruses. So that's where it originally came from, this virus. It's over in South America too.
Because there's only been a half, because when it was
I wonder
in Africa,
if it's a mosquito that flew across the Atlantic or whether it was
the, mosquito,
the Rockefeller Foundation.
But how could the mosquito have the H5N1 coronavirus in
birds.
It anyway? But that is to do with the bird flu, is it? It makes no sense. Birds are not linked with mosquitoes.
You live on what we call LA, don't you?
Yeah, baby.
Has anything ever really happened out there? Red, I'd better ask you first.
No. It's just one road. Has this nice farm down one side. Then you get to the middle and it's where a lot of not very pleasant people from the age of about 15 to 18 live and hang outside the co-op and cause mischief. And then on the other side, it's where we live. It's literally just one long road.
But in all fairness, if there was somewhere for them to go, if there's going to be nowhere for people to hang out, yes, they are going to loiter outside shops.
Is there a sort of anywhere for young people to go around?
No, they did have a bus at one point, didn't they?
They had where we used to get the meat and veg from in the community.
That was the bus thing, wasn't it?
Oh, I have no clue. I cannot remember. But there's a park and they do little... I don't know.
So it's not a lot of like community type facilities, much.
And it's more than quadrupled in size as well.
There's a lot of development going on.
Still,
Do you know anything about the Long Ashton Research Station? Because wasn't there some sort of
genetic... Is that changed into the big houses in that now?
I'm not sure if it's been built on. But yeah, Long Ashton Research Station was where some sort of genetic engineering used to go on back in the 1960s and 70s. I'm pretty sure. It wasn't a government research agriculture thing down there?
It was, yeah. That was behind where we used to live, Fenswood Cottages. That's right behind there. Yes, that's been built on.
And I worked in Salisbury in the early 1990s, and there they had, it was just closing down at the time, something called the Common Cold Research Establishment, where they were looking into all this swine flu. Well, I don't know if it's swine flu, but they used to give people virulent influenza and then watch them, see how they managed to get on.
Maybe that's what they were doing with the mosquitoes when they sent them over to South Africa.
I mean, there is a thin line, though, isn't there, between... studying these kinds of viruses, which are really can go between people very quickly, and germ warfare.
There's a thin line
between the two,
I mean, let's be honest, after the Second World War, all those because they were extremely intelligent, they might have been arses, but they were extremely intelligent people over in Germany doing all those very evil experiments. What happened to them? Where did they go? All their notes they wrote, they couldn't have all been burnt, thrown up and everything. All those experiments that were being done, where's not that I would like to see the input, but through everything that had happened, it must have been distributed in different ways throughout. Like you said about in Africa, the Zika virus institution.
Oh, this Rockefeller place in the Zika forest.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, and I can remember actually 1970s and 1980s where we still had some decent television to watch here in Britain.
You're old, yeah.
I know, 1975, I think it was, there was a series called The Survivors, which almost every time there's one of these outbreaks, I remember the opening credits of that.
Mm.
Program. It was a drama series. I think it was on every week, prime time on a Saturday night or something. And it was the people who'd survived a massive germ warfare wiped out the whole planet. I think it was, they said something like 1 in 100,000 people survived it. And the opening credits were this Oriental guy getting onto a plane and being stamped, his passport being stamped with all these different cities around the world like New York, London, etc. And then he was wiping his head because he was starting to sweat as he was spreading this virus on this plane around the world. And it and there was, so that's well worth watching if you haven't ever caught up with that. It's because it's it looks at the sort of society that would be left after something like that, you know, with only 1 in 100,000 people left in Britain.
There was that
how
book as
would
well.
You survive?
48, was it James Herbert who wrote the book 48? I'm not sure, which was the about the Second World War. The anyone with a certain blood group, I think it was Rhesus negative or O, a certain blood group. So the majority of people died that didn't have this blood group. So it's the same sort of thing, but on a different level.
Yeah, I'd definitely recommend. I think they filmed it in Herefordshire, quite a lot of it. But that was when you used to switch on the TV and find something worth watching, which
we
you very,
had three channels, didn't
very
you?
Rarely do nowadays.
It's like video games. There's a new one called Fallout 4, and this, they get a bomb scare, like a nuclear bomb. So they all have to go into these downstairs chambers. This is like the opening storyline bit. And then they get escorted into these little capsule coffin-y things to be in. Then they get frozen for like 100, 200 years. And yeah, and you go up and then you have to like... And then everyone's a zombie who was like left with deformities and stuff from.
So what, after 100 years, so the zombies mated?
No, I don't know. Oh. I didn't actually email the people asking, but it's like, oh my God, this is a video game.
Mm.
Yeah, a bit creepy, isn't it, really? I mean,
it was like in the 50s as well, when the chemical warfare, or they would say a bomb would
this was set in the 50s. Wipe out.
Yeah. Just go under the table and hug with your children. You'll be fine. If you made a house out of sand and blew it, that would disappear. That's what would happen if the atom bomb did come across. Yet they were told, weren't they, in the 50s, just to hide under the table and chair. You'll be fine.
Yeah, it's a these dystopian video games, though. I mean, actually, must affect you. Have you played these sorts of things?
Yeah.
Oh, please say.
And you love
hasn't.
Them, or do you feel that it makes you a bit creepy? Or
I get really scared because basically, I got this as a present for my boyfriend. And I was just like, oh God, I spent loads of money for him now to not speak to me because he's going to play on the Xbox all the time. So I went round and I actually got really scared and I felt like we were watching a horror movie. Ugh. And I'd sort of close my eyes and be like, Oscar, please, can you do the rest of it? I can't complete this level. It's making me feel sick and queasy. And the remote would shake when something would happen.
There's a sort of psychological side to this, though, isn't it? Because it's kind of desensitizing young people, where you're not really, it's only on a video game, and if you don't do it, then you're some kind of weak-minded person, and you've got to be tough and mean and cruel. I know they also use the people who score very well on some of these games, and then they try and recruit them to be things like drone operators, or you know.
I'm not that intense, but I do know a friend of a friend who gets paid to play COD, which is like a fighting game. He gets paid like 20 grand to win a fight against someone, and he's like moved to America now. And yeah, he gets paid.
So he's been recruited basically.
A lot of money for.
But you don't know who you're fighting. Well, fighting a drone somewhere that's.
I don't know. Oh. Yeah, I don't know.
You don't know if it's really somebody you might be killing on the other end of the thing, do you, really?
Bum, bum, bum.
It's a bit weird, isn't it? Also, we've got this new designer babies. That's what they're doing here in Britain. Britain is going to be the first country in the world to do this, where they say, okay, sign on the dotted line on your checkbook and tell us what characteristics you want in your child.
That's natural. Oh my gosh.
But Sherry,
I'm really sorry I've had children, and I'm really sorry that I brought you into this, Rhett.
It's a bit of a crazy world we're living in at the moment. I mean, I think the thing is, at least there is some kind of, it's provoking a kind of discussion about, well, this is wrong, you know, and particularly with the things like the possible release of a genetically modified Zika mosquito, which might have made this whole Zika virus thing wrong. At least people are talking about it.
Everything links back to David Attenborough. You just need to watch a David Attenborough documentary and realise that we're just animals and we're just meant to live a life. We're not meant to, like,
conquer
and
devour.
And
well, isn't part
everything.
Of the problem is that we think we're animals. We're actually, we're people and we're different to animals. And that because we think we're animals, we start behaving like them and we start to go into that kind of survival of the fittest
absolutely
mindset.
Not.
You know,
people say animals as if humans aren't animals and place themselves above them.
Well, we are. Disagree. We've got a lot more responsibility for what goes on than the animals do.
Yeah, but only because we've developed over the past, I don't know, hundreds and thousands of years. Like, we were monkeys. Like, they live animal lives. They're
they
not
are
like.
They're pretty violent, though, aren't they?
Yeah, but they're not like, oh, hey, I'm going to text my friend and get him over so we can, I don't know, go
but
to
nor
a party.
But nor did we till, what was it, the 70s, when you used to talk on your mobile phone?
I actually
Scotty.
Don't remember. That was 20 years before I was born, so.
Didn't he? But it was Spock used to talk on his mobile phone. He'd go, beam me up, Scotty. We didn't know anything about that.
Now we can FaceTime.
Yeah.
Anyway, maybe the debate about evolution or creation and about man and the animals is for another time. But Cherie and Red, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
That is all right.
On Dialect.
Cheers. Bye for now.
Well, that's all for this week. Dialect is Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast and has been broadcast on community radio stations in Bristol, Swindon, Preston and St Albans. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails or download the podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, Chris Pothicary, who's been from Yeovil, but he's just come back from Colombia and off again back over there soon. Also to Sherry and Red Townsend from LA. Well, that is Long Ashton to you and I. Also to studio engineer Dave Bazenko. Dialect's a Bristol Broadband Co-op production, and anyone can contribute. Contact us through the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, who are just off Jamaica Street. Call them on 0117 909 6897 or visit them on the web at prsc.org.uk. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling. Wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Until the same time next week, goodbye for now.